Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming today. Welcome to the FCC. I hope you're enjoying your lunch. Please continue after I've introduced the speaker, who will be. I'll do that shortly. I think as Warren Buffett said famously, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. One thing that financial journalists and auditors have in common is that when the tide does go out, we're asked why we didn't do a better job watching the swimmers. We've organized here at the FCC many speakers and events looking at how we as journalists can do a better job. And we're delighted to have today as our speaker someone who is probably one of the best experts on the subject of professional skepticism. Michael Andrew is a qualified lawyer as well as the global head of KPMG, one of the big four international audit firms. He is also the first to be based in Hong Kong. KPMG, other auditors have been very much in the news, and we're very delighted to have Michael here to speak today. Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, Douglas, thank you for that very kind introduction. And can I say this is sort of my baptism to Hong Kong. I've moved here on the 1st of October and already starting to enjoy some of the pleasures of this city. And the first question I'm always asked is, why did I choose Hong Kong? And it really is quite simple. There's essentially three reasons. The first is, when you actually look at the markets, which are really, really important to the big four accounting firms, clearly it's China, it's India, it's Korea, it's the ASEAN group, it's these emerging countries. And to be right in the middle of it, I think makes a very strong statement about the importance that we actually place on this region. Secondly is the infrastructure point. I mean, the ability to effectively walk out of your hotel, get on a train for 30 minutes and be on a plane virtually within an hour logistically, when you compare that to the alternatives in New York or Heathrow or Frankfurt, it is a wonderful asset for the city. And I think third, I think the importance of having such an international community and such an important capital market means that virtually every leader, whether they be a CEO, a private equity participant, an investor, has to come through Hong Kong at some stage during the year. So it's very efficient in terms of actually client connectivity. So personally, I'm delighted to be here. I've got a four-year term, so hopefully you'll see me around Hong Kong, and please come up and introduce yourself. Now, today I was asked to give a very provocative speech, Fraud, Financial Crisis, the Future of the Big Four. And I sort of thought about why you would do that, but then I thought, well, if you said we're going to talk about auditing for 25 minutes, I may not have got too much of a crowd. So I think the turnout today is too much to do with your marketing of your subject. So I'll try and make it a little bit interesting, and then again follow up with questions. What I want to start with is the financial crisis, and as Douglas quite pointed out, auditors are no different to financial analysts in the sense that you had a global financial crisis, taxpayers have had to fund a significant cost across the world. They're asking, why did this happen? What were you doing? Now, from my perspective, you need, I think, first of all, to start from the basis that if you reflect on the last financial crisis in 2002-2003, I think the auditors had a lot to answer for. The ability to lose companies like Enron, WorldCom, I think exposed some very poor governance, some very poor auditing practices that had been allowed systemic over a number of years, and we quite rightly, I think, had to significantly contribute to the compensation for a lot of investors that missed out. I contrast that quite markedly with the collapse in 2008 of the global financial crisis. In fact, I think the auditors did an excellent job, in many ways too good a job, in 2008. 2008 was effectively about a failure of business models, a failure of the prudential supervision system, inadequate attention to risk management, a lack of governance and transparency, and very weak corporate governance practices in many key countries. The comments that I got all the time as a chairman was, you guys were too tough. By marking to market those instruments, you actually introduced financial instability in the system. And I had many regulators and politicians come to me and say, you auditors are actually exacerbating the problem. My answer is we were the canary in the coal mine. We actually identified the risk that was starting to flow through the financial system and really were the ones who forced companies, regulators and rating agencies to address the sorts of issues that came out. Yes, there are a few frauds. Madoff, Swanton were good examples. I'd say to you, I keep reminding people, that these were not audited by any of the major firms. These were things that are systemic that will happen from time to time. Now, therefore, the question's being asked, if you did such a good job, why did this happen? Are you doing the right job? And that's where I think the focus has got to be. What is the future of our profession, of regulators, of rating agencies, to ensure that these things don't happen again? And I'm going to take you through some comments on that today. I thought I would start, however, just by quickly commenting on, as Global Chairman, what are the sort of issues that are on your agenda at the moment, and then feed into the product about how we can actually put more confidence and integrity in capital markets. Well, the first issue I'm having to confront, in fact, the very first day I was announced as Chairman, I got a phone call from the PCAOB, which is the US regulator, to say, could you come in for a cup of tea? And the question they asked me was, first of all, what is an Australian doing running a global accounting firm? And what do you know about audit quality? So after that interview, we then got down to the issues, which were essentially, we're worried about the amount of backdoor listings and IPOs that are happening in emerging markets. And are you comfortable as a global chairman that you have the sorts of audit procedures and processes which ensure that the same standards you apply in New York or London are being applied in these new and emerging markets? And can you give us advice as to how we should actually deal with these matters? Now, my comment to them was, it's no different. I was in Central East Europe in 1992 to 1994, and I saw exactly the same things occur, where you have a number of companies and individuals, often privately held, who don't fully understand the consequences of participating in capital markets, who don't apply the same standards, and actually see this as an easy source of finance. It's very important, therefore, that there be proper education of these people by the audit firms, the investment banks, the regulators, the underwriters, to make sure that they fully understand the consequences of going down this market. Because if you get one or two poor IPOs, it does reflect on the good IPOs. It also reflects upon the markets in which they're allowed to achieve. So, to me, India, China, Africa, they're all on a journey. And in that sense, they're going to continue to enhance and improve their standards. And, you know, they will have to start to deal with global regulators on a much more consistent basis and understand the consequences. And it's really important to get this right, because we've seen some really good high-quality China IPOs in foreign markets, and it's essential that we get better integration and coverage of these people into some of those markets so we can take away a lot of the myths that actually exist. So it's important that we all have procedures and processes which make sure when those listings come to market, they can be relied upon in capital markets by key investors. I'd also make the point that at the moment, I think there's an issue around the governance model that's emerging. We instantly revert to what I'd call a Western governance model. And I think it's little understood in many countries about Eastern governance and Eastern business models and the way things are done in these countries. And I think once you start to get down into that granularity, you'll actually realise that a number of the principles are actually best practice when it comes to governance. I gave a speech last week in Beijing where I actually commented on what I saw as the positive aspects of what I'd call the Chinese governance model. First of all, they are very good long-term thinkers. They look for sustainability over a long period of time, not like the West, who seem constantly wanting to mark to market on a three-month basis. They have a very clear plan, a very clear direction as to what the strategy is that everyone can get around. This is often much more opaque in terms of the companies that report. They have a broader stake of shareholders. They look for their people, their employees, their communities. They think more broadly about those issues in the way they run their business, whereas the Western model seems very aligned to giving the return on shareholders or keeping their bankers off their backs. And finally, I actually think the Chinese are very good at managing risk. I think they think these issues through, and I love quoting the story that the first time I was ever became aware of a CDO, a collateralized debt instrument, was when I heard the deputy chairman of the Bank of China talk in 2006 at Davos and identified this as an emerging risk that they simply didn't understand. Like everyone else, I wish I'd listened harder to that speech. from the West point of view, there's greater transparency, greater disclosure, greater accountability, and increasingly the use of independent experts, as we see on boards and committees, that really, I think, adds value to the Western governance model. The real question for me is, how can you combine both to come up with the right answer? The second issue I wanted to comment on, or that I was asked to comment on, on day three in the job, was how do you account for Greek debt? Now, it sounds a very simple sort of proposition, or at least I thought it was, and then I got on the phone to the various countries around Europe to say, well, what is the carrying value of Greek debt? And I was amazed to hear you don't adjust anything, you adjust it down to 55 cents, you take 21 cents on the dollar. So it became very apparent to me very quickly that there was a lack of consistency in the way these matters were treated. And what shocked me even more was the political and regulatory interference that we got as accounting firms in actually trying to apply this across Europe. Now, I'd say we got it about 90% right. And as it's turned out, I think you'll find most of the European banks actually correctly marked down the Greek debt to effectively what was been agreed by the European Rescue Package. But the contortions that one had to go through to get there indicated to me the importance of having one consistent set of global standards properly applied across the world. And the sooner we get there, the better off we're all going to be. As you might imagine, we're facing a very difficult 2011 year end. Most of the European banks balance at the end of December. So you can imagine that the problem is now just a Greek problem, and we're having to sit down and have a hard look at the carrying value of many of these bonds that are held, determine where those rescue packages will actually be put in place to actually underwrite the value of some of this volatility. So, and of course, this flows then into what is the regulatory capital that's available still in some of these banks, and how do we deal with these sort of matters. So it's going to be a very difficult 2011 period for our auditors, but I think we understand clearly the issue. The thing that's working for us now is that I think the regulators and a number of the large companies who are resistant to change now understand the market consequences of actually not being transparent and dealing with these issues. Because there were some very good analyst reports, particularly one put out, I think, by Morgan Stanley, which really, I think, compared the companies that had taken the write-offs, and a result of which a number of companies lost significant value on their share price very, very quickly once investors really found out that they were not necessarily marking to market. The other issues that are on my plate are, I suppose, the increasing reliance now on auditors to deal with some of the new legislation around the world, particularly when it comes to issues like corruption. We've seen the recent UK Anti-Corruption Act places obligations on us to report. We've dealt with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act for a number of years. And increasingly, we're starting to look at those types of issues now as part of our statutory responsibility. That's quite tough, because as you can imagine, these things are always not black and white, and the definitions change in different jurisdictions. We're also having to look at the issue of money laundering, where under the Patriot Act, we have actually had responsibilities put on us as to how to basically identify these types of transactions. And when you have global turmoil, as you might see in the Middle East at the moment, these are the sort of consequences that often give rise to those flows of funds, which we have to be very careful about. We're also having to look at issues like tax morality, where I think now, as taxpayers are increasingly being called upon to fund global governance positions, you have this attack by the G20 on tax havens around the world and some of the more nebulous practices around this. This has consequences for us in terms of how we go about advising on these issues. And the final issue I'd note is we're seeing a significant incidence in cyber attacks around the world and how just whether there is sufficient IT security around dealing with a number of these issues. So that just gives you a list of the sort of things that are on my plate. The overwhelming issue that I am dealing with at the moment is the great desire by regulators to impose a number of policy changes which impact the audit profession and therefore capital markets. There's almost an unhealthy race to get this done. And I think it comes back to my original point. The way I start to say is, the important thing is here, we did our job, but did we do the right job? And what can we actually do to actually improve the outcomes for all investors? Now, most noticeably, we have papers from the US and the PCIB. We have major changes taking place in Korea, in Brazil. So it's a global phenomenon. But by far, the greatest impact at the moment is a green paper which has been put forward by Commissioner Barnier in Europe, which advocates a number of things. Now, I'd like to just comment on his proposals and then tell you where I think it should be headed. The first one, he's dealing largely with market structure. He's worried about the too big to fail issue. He's worried about the lack of choice and concentration in markets between audit firms. It's interesting, the US have come out and said there is no market concentration issue. This is the most competitive environment you have. We just don't see this as an issue. So already we have this dimension that we have to actually deal with between different priorities in the US. They're more focused on how do we lift quality, how do we make sure that people can actually rely upon the financial statements and information that they're actually given. Barnier also looks at two other issues, which is portability, the ability for an auditor in a Central East European country like Denmark to be able to do work in the UK, etc., which we support. And he's also looking at increasing the regulatory oversight so we have a pan-European approach to regulating the audit profession. Again, we're very supportive of those measures. He has put together, however, four proposals that were leaked to the press quite deliberately some time ago. The first one is audit-only firms. He says if you actually have more than 30% of the audit market, you are not allowed to have any other capability other than being auditors. Now, this, frankly, is rather naive, because in any audit, you need sophisticated advisory skills. You've got to have actuarial skills, IT specialists, treasury specialists, tax specialists, and you're simply not going to recruit and retain the best people in your organisation if they're not currently in tune with the market. If they're out there giving advice on those types of issues, then they're going to be picking up the sort of issues that are emerging and be able to embed those into the audit quality. The other thing, if you actually think about combining that with some of these other measures like rotation, frankly, it doesn't become a very good business model. It's actually going to, in many ways, in my view, increase concentration. So we've actually done our numbers, and if we ever had to come to that situation, it's simply a matter we would just release and refuse to do a number of audits and make sure we got below the 30% threshold. That would be the right business model for us. So it's actually not achieving a lot. The second issue, he's introduced joint audits, and he said that on any major audit, 35% of that audit must be done by a small firm. Again, this is a concept, joint audits, which is a French concept, and it is actually applied in France on many occasions. But can you imagine the practicality of this? If you have a Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, it would mean that 35% of the audit would have to be done by a very small firm with no geographic capability, no specialist services, no banking skills embedded. So it means that we would also be jointly liable as a big four firm doing an audit with that firm. So we ourselves, we would have to then seriously consider whether we would actually even continue to do those types of audits. So again, this is a very flawed concept. The third concept is to ban all non-audit services, so the auditor can only do audits and can't do anything else. Now, this again is quite naive, because often the audits committee will want additional work done in areas of assurance. So if you're concerned about, you know, revenue assurance, if you're concerned about doing some desktop due diligence and making sure how your accounting policies would actually apply to a potential target, if you're actually doing some small and medium enterprise and you want to integrate your accounting and your tax, it's quite common to use the same firm. The reality is there are rules. The SEC have been operating under this for several years. There's a list of prohibited services which people need to stick to. The key is, if it's the audit committee themselves who make those decisions, then that becomes their choice to explain to shareholders what is in, and make the judgment as to what is in the best interest of shareholders, not have this imposed from a regulatory perspective. The fourth point he makes is he wants compulsory rotation of audits and tendering. Now, there is a number of countries where audit rotation does actually occur. And there are views as to whether that improves quality. It certainly improves, I think, the outlook from outside to say, well, the auditor changed every 10 or 20 years, so fresh eyes, that means professional scepticism is being practiced. However, the empirical evidence is that just about all major audit failures often occur during that first initial change of auditor. That's when it becomes relatively high risk. There's also a very, very big cost to changing over an auditor because in these large companies, you have to change auditors in so many countries around the world, but it probably means you then have to change your internal auditor, you have to change your tax advisor, you have to change your valuation expert. These are the knock-on consequences that actually come from this proposal. Plus, inevitably, you're going to drive down pricing if you retender that, which means that will impact quality, people will start to take the shortcuts, and therefore I don't think you're going to get the right sort of attitude. The FRC, the UK regulator, has a very sensible proposal which we support. In other words, every 10 years, the audit committees must disclose in their financial statements why they haven't tendered the audit, explain why they think they are actually getting that independent and professional sceptical approach. These are, in my view, the right approach to the problem if you think it's a problem. Now, it's interesting, Mr. Barnier never at once consulted with any of the big four audit firms. In fact, he's been quite deliberately not consulting with us. We've had almost 85% of all the submissions put into Barnier rejected his proposals outright. Nevertheless, he's published them anyway. Third, I'd say to you that we didn't get... The really disappointing thing about the Barnier report is that investors made almost no submissions. So the submissions just about always came from regulators, from government, and from auditing firms or clients. The professional investors just didn't even participate, which, you know, asking a question, does this mean this is not an important issue to them? And finally, I think last week, the commissioners themselves in Europe had a first look at this. They have pulled back on the draft regulation, that will now be issued as a draft sometime in the next few weeks, which will be discussed over the next 36 years. It's 36 months, hopefully. Don't report that. But rather than just saying, you know, we've been standing by and saying as audit firms, look, there's a lot that can be done. So can I just concentrate and give you 10 things that I think should happen to actually improve the quality of auditing around the world? The first, you've got to strengthen the global corporate governance to best practice. I have been fortunate to be the lead partner on BHP Billiton, the third largest company in the world. It's a triple listed company. It's listed in the UK, the US, and in Australia. At the same time, they have compliance obligations in many other countries around the world from a statutory point of view. They benchmark the best corporate governance around the world, and they pick the jurisdiction that they think has the highest standards, and they adopt that through the group. What that showed me, first of all, was there is no global template as to what is best practice in terms of corporate governance principles, and secondly, that best practice is actually shared among a number of countries. This concept that best practice is all concentrated in the UK or Australia or Canada or the US is false. I think the greatest, I think the UK might have had 33% of what they regarded as their best practice, the US more like 20%. So, you know, you need to actually put this together on a global blueprint basis. Secondly, you have to really start to strengthen and, I think, mandate the use of audit committees. And when you think about it, the audit committees are there to represent the shareholders. They have a fiduciary duty to do the right thing by that company. So they are accountable. They have a vested and aligned interest in making sure that they have a robust audit, because ultimately it protects their situation. And it's important to make sure that it's just not a process, that you actually have a real financial expert on those audit committees who can challenge the risk management framework, the governance, the reporting, and, you know, be up to date with the modern thinking around these issues. Third, we do need a global set of accounting standards. And the situation now where we've had this standoff between Europe and the United States now for a number of years around IFRS really has to be brought to an end. We need to have analysts, banks, regulators all be able to look at the same financial statements and compare them across jurisdiction. But those standards have got to be set independently of any political interference. They have to reflect commercial and business practice. And this is what's missing at the moment. So the reason the US won't sign up at the moment to IFRS is that they are concerned that too many governments come in and want to change or override these standards when it suits them, as we saw during the sovereign debt crisis. So these are valid concerns. So we have to make sure that this is an apolitical process. The second thing is, at the moment, there's very little participation from Asia in the setting of these standards. And it's really important, as we start to talk about governance models in the East and the West, that they start to have more say and more input that reflects the way business is done here and what they see as best practice, not just accept as being dictated. Fourth, and this is a more controversial point, but if the auditor hasn't done its job, then you should expand the audit. We should be asked to do the things that actually are important for investors. So, for example, it's uncommon that auditors actually look at the investor pack that actually set out, the MDA report that actually goes out to analysts to the marketplace. These aren't audited numbers. So in any ways, there's no assurance around this information. In the UK, where you have a major transaction, it's compulsory to audit the synergies. If you say, I'm going to take over this company, I'm going to deliver this amount of revenue and cost synergies, it is set by corporations law that the auditors must agree with those numbers and actually audit the fact that they exist. Surely that's critical information that investors look for, yet it's not audited in many jurisdictions. I can tell you, some of it is interestingly calculated. There's also critical ratios. I mean, do you want to have audited the return on investment, the cost to income ratio of various banks, the carbon reductions, the safety performance of organisations? What are the things that investors need to actually base their investment decisions on? They're the sort of things on which we should be getting assurance. not just saying that the accounts are true and fair on a historical basis. Fifth, why don't we expand the audit report? If this is expectation gap, why do we just say the accounts are true and fair in accordance with international accounting standards? Why don't we say that we actually looked at the carrying value of goodwill, that we actually looked at some of the critical risks that the business face, that the business model itself was robust in a time where there might be liquidity issues, you know, that we actually did examine these issues. Now, what we need to avoid here is boilerplate coming through, and the other thing we need to avoid is a situation that maybe it's the companies who should be saying this, not the auditors. So this is the sort of debate or discussion that we need to have. So extend the scope of audit, expand the audit report. Six, set a regime for non-audit work. We just want to know what the rules are. At the moment, it is really difficult to actually opine or make judgments around what is allowed and what is not allowed. In my view, we should just pick up the US SEC model. It's worked very well over a number of years and have it administered by the audit committees. Seven, you should mandate cooperation between auditors and prudential regulators. In Germany, it's compulsory every 3 months for the banking, insurance and funds management area to go and have discussions with your prudential regulator around the organisation, its risk, what they see as the emerging issues, what their concerns are. So there's a forced exchange of information, which has got to add to the robustness of the banking system once those things are shared. At the moment, in many countries, that just don't occur. Eight, why don't auditors actually comment on the risk management and control framework of organisations? I mean, this is what Sarbanes-Oxley was. Now, that's a fairly blunt way of getting to that result, but I think in hindsight, many US companies are probably in a better place today because they went through that particular process. Now, I think there are more effective ways, frankly, personally, to getting the right answer, but I think you'd have to get some positive assurance around those issues and put greater external views or input on the fact that the control environment is working correctly. Nine, I think we need to be much more transparent about the initiatives people take around audit quality. Now, whether that is a regulator making comments like the PCAOB do, or whether it's the audit firms themselves producing more information about the way they go about enhancing audit quality, I think it would take a lot of the issues out of the debate once you see the very sophisticated way that we firms actually go about dealing with these types of issues. And my final issue is we need to have a coordinated global regulatory oversight in terms of the audit profession. At the moment, we are caught in a situation where there's different policy positions taken in different regulators, and we find ourselves caught in the middle, often enough, with competing regulators wanting different rules or different standards. So in the same way that people want the big accounting firms to actually have a consistent role across the world in terms of quality and product, then I think also there's incumbent upon regulators also to rise to that issue. Now, there are consequences in everything I've said. I've done it at a relatively high level. There are cost issues, there are client confidentiality issues, there are regulatory, there are sovereignty issues. My point is, let's have a debate on the things that really matter, not some of the proposals that are put up at the moment. We, as a Big Six, are very happy to have an engagement and discussion about what we can do to ensure that we actually deal with the next global financial crisis well and truly in advance and can restore confidence in capital markets. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael, for that presentation. And can I say that we're always very happy here at the FCC to have transparency and any issues you want to flag to us, or you know, anything you spot down that coal mine, we'd be happy to talk to you about it. Michael's very kindly agreed to take some questions from the audience today. Can I ask that you raise your hands and wait for the mic to come to you and identify yourself before you ask the question? Do we have any questions right now? The gentleman at the front, please.
I'm Bob Meyer with PharmaLink. I've been in Hong Kong 33 years, and we've had several financial crises here, although not recently. And at the time, we looked to the United States and said, well, you know, we need a scheme of regulation as you have in the U.S. and the SEC, and the ability to form class actions and treble damages and all the rest of it. None of that prevented an Enron or a WorldCom from occurring. And in fact, Hong Kong's been much better. We haven't had a Carrion scandal, if anyone remembers that one, or a big flop here in some time. And when I hear your comments, I agree with virtually everything you say, but having had practical experience, there's a big cost in doing this. There's a big chilling effect on businesses to have to comply with this. Businesses hate Sarbanes-Oxley right now and are trying to get away from it and out of it. And then the question also comes up with all the regulation you had in the United States before Sarbanes-Oxley. It didn't work anyway in the cases of the worst frauds. So I'm not sure what my question is. That's a comment. Yeah, I appreciate what you have to deal with, and I maybe you could respond to what I just said.
Okay, sure. Look, you know, I'm quite sympathetic to your view because, as I said to you, I don't think the U.S. regulatory environment is best practice. And please don't write that I'm in favour of introducing Sarbanes-Oxley type legislation around the world. In fact, you know, in the jurisdiction I came from, there had to be a positive assurance statement given by the directors that the internal control framework was efficient and effective in basically identifying those issues. So they managed to, in one paragraph, put what was in legislation for hundreds of pages, and it had the same effect. You know, there's been very little in the way of corporate scandals, and every company has diligently applied those principles in getting to the right answer. So, regulation will never, in my view, totally prevent these sort of corporate scandals from occurring. To me, it goes back to the ethics, the principles that people are applied in the marketplace. And I think in Hong Kong, my experience is, and I give a tremendous amount of credit to the stock exchange here, in terms of the listing process that's gone through. It's, most people tell you, it's the most rigorous in the world, and that the listing committee often almost play the role of independent directors in questioning the information that comes to them. And that, to me, is a good example that you see as to why you probably haven't had the same instance of problems that that arise here. That said, you know, I think it's also important to understand that when you actually look at the number of frauds that occur, it's actually relatively tiny. Some of them are big, they're high profile, they're written about, but in terms of the number of filings that are put out on a global basis, there's a very small incidence, really, of major failures and major frauds. And as I said, in 2008, to me, this was a failure of business models, not a, you know, there was only one or two frauds that really did occur of a high magnitude. It was basically lack of prudential supervision.
Hi, Tara Joseph with Reuters. You mentioned briefly about China over lunch. I think you have 10,000 people in China at the moment. And obviously there's been a lot of press about Chinese firms listening in the United States. I'm wondering if in the background of that and some concerns about the auditing of those companies, whether you're going to slow your growth of your business in China in the next year, or whether you're concerned about how things are going there?
No, like anyone, we're concerned about some of the quality issues that have come down. We've had to basically look at some of our audit processes and procedures and how they apply in the Chinese environment and make sure that, you know, we do additional work to actually assure the quality there. But we still see China as being one of the significant sort of growth areas. Where what we're seeing a shift now is, traditionally, it's been the state-owned enterprises who have gone through the IPO route. What we're now seeing is more of the private companies and groups that are starting to look for capital, whether that be in Hong Kong or overseas, and just making sure that our procedures and processes are geared up to make sure that there is quality and integrity in those listings, for example. Because, you know, frankly, we can't afford too many more scandals. Otherwise, Chinese companies will have difficulty accessing capital markets, which would be, I think, a tremendous shame for everyone.
So you're not going to slow down your business in China as a result?
Or? Not at all, no. In fact, we'd probably increase our investment in China. We're looking at opening more offices there as those markets expand to deal with these new and emerging issues. The other thing we've done is, this year, is we have established desks in 41 countries around the world to actually service major Chinese companies going out of China into those markets to make sure we understand the culture, the local accounting requirements at both the China level and the local level. So we're actually heavily recruiting in China with a view to placing a lot of these people overseas to get different experience and track really what we see as being the key investment flow that's occurring around the world at the moment.
I'm going to abuse my position here, just follow up on China. You mentioned from the podium that big audit firms can be caught between different regulators. There's obviously a robust discussion going on between the PCAOB, the American regulator, and the Chinese regulators now. What are your thoughts about how that might play out, and what's the best outcome?
Oh, and the best outcome. The best outcome is it gets resolved, because you know we face situations where we get requests for both of them. When one requests information from us, the other one says, slaps a subpoena or something else to say you can't give that information to the other party. So we find ourselves caught in the middle. Now, I think over time this will work itself out, and we will get to some basis of joint inspections. Processes that are actually occurring, and you know, I've been through some joint inspection processes in other countries. You know, that model has still got some work to be done to make sure that they are efficient and effective. But you know, I'm sure with the right dialogue, these issues will start to be worked out once each party makes a bit more of an effort to understand what the other one's trying to achieve.
Not there. Oh, sorry. Oh, sorry. The gentleman in the corner there.
Jeffrey Crothall, China Labour Bulletin. Just to follow up again on expansion in China, there was a lot of discussion in the Chinese media in the first half of this year about the pressures that employees at the Big Four were facing, workers actually dying because of overwork. And there was talk of pressing for unionization of Big Four in China. Has there been any progress towards unionization in China? And if not, why not?
Not sure I'm the right person to answer your question. I certainly know that we have formed our own Communist Party within our China firm to basically represent their sort of those rights coming forward. We think that's the right thing to do in terms of our employees. I certainly would be horrified to think of any of our employees were in that situation that you described, where their health was being impacted because of the work hours that were placed upon them. It is not consistent with, you know, the whole values of what we are in terms of an organisation, and making sure we have a high performance culture, but recognises that, you know, work-life balance is pretty important to the long-term, the longevity of those employees. Sorry, I'm not hearing you. So,
would you consider unionisation of your China operations?
Oh, I think that's, look, I'd have to consult my China management on that. I don't really know what the you know costs and benefits of those things are. But you know, we have many countries around the world where we do have a unionised workforce.
I think I saw a question at the back. Was there? Yep, Michael Flaherty, I think, standing there from Reuters.
Thanks. Hi, Mike Flaherty from Reuters. Regarding Olympus, it seems that in 2008, KPMG did see something and reported it to the company, and then, of course, we all know what happened after that. And I think, you know, two questions. Looking back, is that a flaw in the system? I mean, should an auditor at that point, you know, having been told by a company to basically beat it, should there be some kind of disclosure following something like that? Obviously, we've seen what's happened since. That's the first question. Second question is, speaking of Japan in general, I mean, we've talked a lot about China. With everything going on right now, what needs to happen in Japan? What will happen in Japan after this very massive scandal?
First of all, can I say that I'm a bit constrained about what I can say with Olympus, because there is an investigation going on by the Japanese authorities. But let me try and answer some of your points. The first thing is, in 2008, you're right, we did our job, and we were displaced as auditors as a result of doing our job. There are local reporting requirements that auditors have to make. We took independent legal advice at that time and followed that advice. So we complied with all of our obligations to pass on the information we had to the relevant parties within Japan. The second issue is, I think, so I'm pretty comfortable that, you know, in 2008 we did all the right things. What I think is unproven to me is what happened in the early years that management have disclosed. And, you know, we inherited the former Anderson firm here, so, you know, it's a bit vague as to exactly what happened in those early years. But what is pretty evident to me is that there's a very, very significant fraud where a number of parties have been complicit in that fraud, and that we should wait for the Japanese authorities to disclose that. As a result of which, I think it's very hard to jump to the conclusion that it's a corporate governance failure. Yet it may well be systematic of Japanese corporate governance, but I would just, I don't, it's too early to call that. In my view, I mean, it's real, it's like saying with Madoff, does this mean a past, you know, major failure in the U.S. corporate governance system if something of that magnitude was able to occur? So, I would just reserve our opinions until this report is published. And I understand it'll be a very full and comprehensive report of what actually has happened.
We're coming close to the end, but I'm sure there must be some. There may be some a final question or for Mr. Andrew.
Tony Watson with Lim Advisors. We're a Hong Kong-based fund manager. In your remarks, you mentioned that there was no empirical evidence to support the efficacy of regular auditor changes. Could you just expand a little bit on that?
There are a number of studies done in Europe which basically have had situations where audit rotation has been part of their corporate governance and rules. And when they actually went back and actually traced where the failures occurred, they tended to occur in the first 2 years of after a change of auditor. And it's not unusual because, I mean, it does take you quite a while in a sophisticated organisation to understand the business model, the efficacy of management, the systems, control weaknesses and so on. So, as a result of which, there are a number of countries that have actually abandoned the whole issue on audit rotation. For example, I think Denmark, Korea, two that come to my mind. That said, look, there's different philosophies. There are some countries like Brazil, we're seeing a little bit in China, where you know rotation does occur. And so you know, this, what I'm saying is that it's a good discussion to have as to whether this is improving audit quality or not improving audit quality.
Okay, well, we've reached 2 o'clock, unless there is someone who's got a question they're really desperate to ask, and Michael would like to indulge that. I think I'll thank you all very much for coming. Please can you all join me in thanking Michael for a fascinating presentation and taking all our questions.